I'm Coulter DeVries, owner of Ranch Investor Advisory and Brokerage Services. As a former commercial and ag banker, my main reason for doing this podcast is to simply gauge the market's appetite for crowdsourcing investment in a ranch real estate fund.
The Ranch Investor Podcast, curated by subject matter experts to give you immense benefit, because we believe your time is valuable.
Well,
all right,
Andy Ron, welcome back to the Ranch Investor Podcast.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
It's been a while.
It has. It has.
I think we all have a bone to pick with you.
Uh-oh.
I had a client call me this week.
Did I screw up another deal?
Yeah, you're always doing that. But he called me and he has roughly $12 million worth of property, ranch real estate that he would consider selling. He's also been adding to it, looking for opportunistic deals. You know, he's got about $2 million to play with. And for the last, what has it been now, almost 2 years, definitely a year and a half, definitely a year, I've been telling him, we talk like once a week, and he's heavily invested in the stock market and commercial real estate, so he's pretty in touch with what's going on. And I've been telling him, hey, with rising interest rates, definitely a slow in demand, we're going to see an increase in supply. With rising supply, prices should come down. And he called me this week to say, Coulter, I think you need to eat crow. I think you've been wrong for too long now. You've been telling me that rising interest rates and rising supply means prices are going to come down. And yet it seems like prices continue to climb. And if you look at the Case-Shiller index for homes, which homes may or may not be correlated to rural and ranch real estate, but the Shiller is back up. And there's been this, like, I mean, Coulter here, I want to call it a dead cat bounce, but we're in this crazy place. It must be inflation. I mean, there's low supply relative to 3-4 years ago.
That's what I was going to say. Supply hasn't bounced back yet. I mean, it's inching back up, but inching is the word.
Why inching?
I mean, it's just so slow. I mean, it's just not. I mean, I'm looking right now. I'm looking at my website, looking at Montana Land Source. Today, there's 359 properties on the market. And pre-COVID, you know, 600 or 700 was the norm. So we're still at half.
We're still at half.
Yeah. Pre-COVID. We got down to a low of just below 300. I think last December was in the high 290s. That's the lowest I've ever seen it. And so we're inching back up, but just a little. We're not back. We're not rebuilt.
I've heard it explained that we're inching back up, and this is, I'm going to correlate rural residential farm and ranch to residential, which I, you know, I'm definitely no expert there with homes. But I'm going to say that they are correlated to a certain extent.
Yeah. I actually am shocked how often they sort of follow each other.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting since they're such different, vastly different classes.
I would agree.
Vastly different entry points price-wise.
Well, and the rebound of home supply, granted, home supply because of developers can be far more volatile than rural farm ranch.
Right.
Because you can actually create home supply. But I would assume the majority of home supply comes from active participants in the market, sellers.
Yeah.
And with that, someone was saying that you're not seeing an increase in supply drastically because today's interest rates, 7-8%, it is too expensive to get out of your current mortgage. If you were to sell today and your current mortgage is 3.5%, you're not gaining. You're going backwards because when you 1031 or if you downsize, upsize, go horizontally, whatever you're going to do, your new money is double that.
And doesn't a residential have the same problem as land as what's your replacement going to be?
Right.
Aren't you now, you know, essentially stepping into a seller's market, you know?
Yeah.
So fine, you can sell and do pretty well, presumably. But now you're a buyer in a seller's market if you want to replace.
Correct. Yeah. So you're not gaining. You're not working yourself up the economic class social ladder.
So my question, as soon as you start talking about a guy who's thinking now about entering the market, my question is always, what took him so long? Like, why, you know, it's to me, it's funny to think about, because you've heard me say this, I've said it over and over, 2021 was a record-breaking year. It's a year I'm not sure we'll see again in our lifetime as far as just market activity and market growth. So it's interesting to me, these sellers that are, you know, considering entering the market now, like why, you know, they waited for the bubble to pass.
So your question was, why enter now? And my belief is, I still don't think it's, I mean, and granted, people are going to be like, well, you're a salesman.
Yeah. You need volume.
Yeah.
You need inventory.
Of course, you're trying to get me to sell. It's still not a bad time because inflation is still happening. That's why we're still seeing these. Hopefully you get into this a little more today. Some crazy things going on. And that craziness is driven by the uncertainty, I think. It's not just driven by, it's not monovariate, it's multivariate. But one of them is the uncertainty of this inflation. It's still happening.
Well, my question for you is, it seems to me like a lot of these sellers, they hold, they stay, you know, they watch this market, they hold, they don't enter the market as a seller till the bubble passes. Then they want to enter the market and they damn sure want to ask the price that was expected during the peak.
Yes.
So don't you come along as the broker, you know, a year or two later and sit down at the kitchen table and have to have that discussion about pricing and having to be competitive and, you know, it's just, it's not a...
Or someone else comes in behind me and lists it at a price that I recommended.
Well, remember, wasn't it Jim Toth on this podcast a couple of years ago said you want to be the first or the second, what was it? Firstborn, second marriage and third realtor.
That's right. Firstborn, second wife, and third broker.
Yeah. Well, I've said this before, I think on this podcast, I've threatened to do this. I haven't followed through yet, but sometimes I get the impression that my biggest value proposition for broker clients of Montana Land Source is ammunition for sitting down at the kitchen table to bring sellers realistic. And I've threatened to produce a sheet, you know, like a white sheet or like a printable PDF that you could slide across the table on the kitchen table, you know, sitting down with the seller, why not to overprice your ranch? Some stats from the market, some, you know, because that seems to be where a lot of brokers lean into the data I produce.
Well, we had one of those when I was with Clark and Associates Land Brokers, and it's actually supported by university studies. And I forget which university it was. I could pull that initial, it's kind of like an initial sales pitch.
Right. Out.
But we had why you don't overprice is, and maybe things are different after COVID. I don't know, but because we know that the allocation value of residences has changed post COVID.
Yeah.
So maybe this quote unquote overpricing, which there's several brokers and brokerage firms known for doing that. maybe that's changed, but no, it can be, so far it can be supported by research studies. I'll show you that when we're done here.
Don't you think there's a market cycle about every 7 years or so where they look like they go from looking like geniuses to looking like fools?
Yeah, it's kind of like farmers and ranchers get a big win
right
once every 7 to 10 years.
Yeah.
And those overpriced brokers get a big win once every 7 to 10 years.
Right. Well, I remember 2005, you know, things were blowing up in Southwest Montana. I was living in Bozeman at the time, and a broker told me something along the lines of, if you don't price twice what you think the property's worth, are you an idiot or are you serving your client well? Because at that time you'd double the price you think it was worth, and in 2 years you'd be right. The market would catch it.
If time value of money and opportunity cost, are no factor to you.
Which they don't seem like they often are to land sellers.
Correct.
That does not seem to be part of the calculus.
No, definitely not. No. I can be here another 55 years. Yeah, I'm not worried about it.
Right. Exactly.
Well, what is today and what's going on with the market? Give me a summary.
Well, we were talking a little bit before we turned the microphones on. I got a message yesterday from a broker who was looking at the, you know, I've got live stats in Montana Land Source. Every day of the market, you know, we update and publish these live stats. And she was double checking, couldn't believe it. She said, is it true that we are down, you know, 80, 90% in volume of sales from a year ago? And sure enough, today, 86% down in number of sales. So the sales that have happened so far in 2023 are 86% down from the sales in 2022, 164% down from 2021.
And we are just, we're in the third quarter here, August 1st, 2023.
Yeah. And I will say, I will qualify that. I mean, some of that is a rise in off-market transactions. You know, we've seen an increase in that. So that is part of the story. But nonetheless, even with that in play, volume has just come to a standstill almost. We've 92 sales so far in 2023 as opposed to 171 2022.
And I think we have once covered off-market transactions that maybe it's privately, but I'm not afraid to go over it again. Obviously, it's happening because there's an incentive to do it.
Yeah, it seems like there's less of that. I mean, we're definitely, you know, we saw some of the, it tends to be the big brokerages that do it with the big ranches. I mean, there's always off-market transaction, you know, neighbor-to-neighbor kind of stuff, of course. But as far as like big ranches that you're thinking, gosh, why would that not be exposed to the market? Wouldn't that, you know, garner the most, you know, possible buyers in the market kind of deal? I think I've seen a decrease in that actually. See, and I think that's part of the softening of demand. I think that during the peak of demand, you know, these brokers could place buyers, you know, with a couple phone calls kind of deal, didn't need to hit the market. But I see that changing. And by the way, just addressing that off-market thing, we do usually in Montana do find out about those eventually. I mean, we might not always know about them in real time, and it's part of the frustration of putting stats together is, you know, the stats improve as you get further out in time. It's the hardest stat to have accurate is the current today, because you don't know if you have everything that's on the market, that kind of stuff. Like just yesterday, I think I found out about two sales, you know, like a year ago kind of stuff and got it added to the database. So especially, you know, once you get a half a year out or something, you know, we tend to get those sales anyway. And it still shows these results. You know, this difference is not entirely, some people lean into me on that. It's like, well, isn't the volume the same? It's just all happening off market, but there's not that much off market activity.
Couldn't be, no, we are. Are we in one of the most exciting times that you've experienced as an appraiser?
I would say we were. You know, now and from a broker's perspective, this is distinctly unexciting. Not getting commission checks is not very
hard. It's not exciting.
I keep calling it correction. It feels like a correction market. Certainly not a crash. You know, like you said at the beginning, values are still pretty high. I mean, they are down. You know, the stats across the board show them down. But what's tough about that, though, is it's not equal across the board. I mean, if you have an A-plus property, you know, if you have trout and elk and exclusivity, you're gonna sell just fine, maybe even top, maybe even record-breaking, right? So the upper bracket is doing just fine in this market. But I think the correction is the most dramatic as you go down the ladder. And I think that's what happens in times of real hot markets is the C property, D plus and C properties and B properties are the ones that really get lifted, right?
So would they be the most? So going back to 06, Western Montana, we'll just call that neighborhood A plus. Mm-hmm. That was the most volatile.
Yeah, while, absolutely.
While Eastern Montana, no offense, was C. C grade neighborhood,
right?
That was less volatile. There's less variance, but now we have some elk properties, some river properties popping up in eastern Montana. Some
right.
Nuanced markets, highly localized markets of recreation and highly desirable for trophy bull, world-class bull elk.
Right, right.
Do you think that those are now, that it's flipped, that A-plus western Montana is insulated and the further you get from A, so B, C, D, that they are now more volatile?
Yeah, and I wonder if the market's bifurcated a little bit, because when I look at the buyers of eastern Montana properties, some of them prefer the open eastern, more ag. You know, the western Montana, you might argue, what would be the term? You know, it's more like Colorado. It's more, it's gotten crowded. It's gotten, you know, it's expensive. It's crowded. And a lot of these guys like, give me eastern Montana open space, right? So a little bit of a different motivation, maybe. Maybe, you know, western Montana, maybe smaller acreage, got to be close to a, not only an airport, but a ski resort and you know, a fancy restaurant for the wife. And that kind of, that little more upscale community, I guess you'd say, Bozeman, Whitefish, you know, that kind of thing. But the buyers in eastern Montana, you know, want the distance, want the, maybe want more of a legitimate ag operation kind of thing. So I wonder if there's a bifurcation. And you're right. I think that's become more, you know, especially if you are truly looking for some isolation, which I think COVID kind of kicked in a little bit, right? Put a little more of a premium, if that's the right word, on, you know, a couple hours from a decent airport. And I'm truly out there riding my horses, running my cows, can build, you know, the place I want, and hell with western Montana and all the trees and neighbors and expense.
Planning, zoning, county
regulations.
Yep. Yeah,
not to mention political environment. So you're in a, yep. You know, your neighbors are all kind of red like you are. Whereas western Montana, it's now a lot more mixed as far as, right? You got people coming in from all kinds of places with different political views and stuff. It's not, maybe a way to say it, western Montana, you can't necessarily pee and shoot off your porch
anymore.
Yeah.
Yep. There was a time that you could, but now it might get to put in the papers.
So if you want to pee and shoot off your porch, eastern Montana might be your...
Well, that, you know, that 8,500 acre place that I sold in southeast Montana that had, mm-hmm. it had terrain, timber, trophy bull elk, it had water, it had everything, views.
Just no national park or ski resort or a wine bar nearby.
Yeah. No, none of that. It did have... Baker, Montana, Fallon County, 45 miles away, you could land a jet. So, I mean, that helps. But the buyer said, I'm getting a western Montana ranch in eastern Montana at eastern Montana values, and that can't be beat. He said, I've got everything I wanted in a western Montana ranch, I have here. And obviously he felt like he was getting a huge win.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I agree with him. I think he is getting a huge win.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard other stories about like a similar buyer situation of a pretty trophy ranch. And the broker kind of described the guy as a bit redneck, you know? So some of the issues with that trophy ranch, it wasn't as exclusive as one might like, you know, I think that harmed the ranch I'm thinking about, but you know, kind of a redneck buyer, so to speak.
So this would be, I mean, I think you and I plus him, two people make a market. I think this is a new trend. I think this demand for eastern Montana, eastern Wyoming, if it's got some trees, some recreation, water, western South Dakota.
Yeah.
I think that's going to continue. And these, what we call like, islands, you know, these pockets of interest. I think the demand there is going to continue, that they're no longer a hidden gem.
Yeah. And I really do, like I said, think there's kind of a bifurcation in the market. I think western Montana is, you know, it's going to stay strong because, you know, it's beautiful and there's lots of amenities, but I think it's going to appeal more to the out of state. Not that eastern Montana is not going to appeal to out of state, but again, there's kind of a cultural bifurcation, you know.
Definitely.
The the big sky ski, you know, the more skiing oriented or the more, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And, you know, the other way you could talk about it is kind of an authenticity divide. I mean, I think Western Montana by some standards has, you know, lost some authenticity. It's not quite Montana as we recognize it having grown up here. Eastern Montana very much still is. It hasn't, you know,
yeah,
that switch hasn't flipped, and that has its own appeal to, you know, I'll just throw this in. This is more about towns than rural, but I think it kind of exemplifies this. And I think I've told you this, you know, I lived in Bozeman for 17 years, as you know, grew up here in Billings, lived in Bozeman for 17 years, moved back. It's only been 5 years. And I can't tell you at the time I moved, how many people, especially in Bozeman, were just like, wait a minute, you're doing what? You're moving to Bozeman or Billings. Why? And, you know, it was completely voluntary. I didn't come here for a job or a relationship or anything like that. And people could from Bozeman absolutely could not wrap their brain around why somebody would voluntarily move to Billings. 4 or 5 years later, whole different deal. I can't tell you how many people have changed their tune and said, oh, I mean, Bozeman especially, but maybe by extension, all of Western Montana is impacted. Things have changed fast.
Certainly. And you need to use air quotes when you say from.
Quote unquote from.
Air quotes, quote unquote from Bozeman. Yeah.
Well, nobody's from Bozeman. That's
the It's kind of like it's nothing close to your multinational cities. But in my opinion, you take your Sydney, Australia, Melbourne, Australia, Auckland, New Zealand, San Francisco, LA, Seattle. Those are like, they're all the same. They are city states,
right?
They don't have their own culture. They're a culture of multinations, which there's nothing, I'm not putting a value judgment on that. I don't see anything wrong with that, but they're not uniquely their own, in my opinion. And, you know, the people, quote unquote, from there,
right,
would disagree, and they would go up in arms like, oh, Seattle has its own culture, and you don't know what the hell you're talking about.
You are absolutely right. Bozeman is a town of immigrants. And, you know, I was doing appraisal living there, and part of what made it a good place for me is I got out of there a lot. I was traveling all over Montana. And the funny thing is I'd come back and I'd be all kind of charged up from cool people and places I got to see and work with, you know, and nobody knew what I was talking about in Bozeman. Like I could find somebody in Bozeman that had, you know, been to Argentina quicker than someone that had been to Tudot.
Right.
You know, and I'd talk about the landscape. I'd talk about the culture because I, you know, that's why I do what I do. And I would come home legitimately charged up and nobody got it. And that's part of why I moved to Billings. I moved back to Billings, and it's funny. I'll just sneak into the pub station, or, you know, to get a bite on my way into town. And, oh, I was out. So, oh yeah, yeah. My uncle owns it, or, you know,
right.
Right. Everyone has ties.
5 hours away. You're 1 degree of separation from everyone.
Right. Right. I actually hope that Billings and Eastern Montana as a whole embraces that and doesn't rush to sell out its culture. Like you could argue maybe Bozeman and Western Montana has.
Well, the folks in Eastern Montana are already pointing the fingers that sleazy brokers are selling them out.
So we need to export you to, maybe there needs to be a surtax, a special tax, on
brokers.
Everybody hates you until they want to sell and get top price.
Right. Yes. So what do you see going forward here?
I just think we're in this correction period, which is very, very slowed down, you know, obviously volume. And we saw this post 2008, as well, especially, you know, I mentioned this earlier, like the optics get really clear the further out in time you get, you know, you get more data in and stuff like that. And, you know, 2008 seemed so dramatic at the time, but now it looks like just kind of a blip and, in the market. And, you know, there were definitely some extremes on an individual property basis at that time. I mean, I remember, for example, there was an auction, and this family was in a desperate situation. That's why they had to go to auction, and they had turned down an offer for twice what they got a year later at auction.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So we saw some of that, but very little foreclosures actually. I mean, despite nationally that being the story and land in Montana, it was shocking how few of that there was. But anyway, post 2008, you know, we just saw this slowdown, this correction period, this just kind of let things sort out. I think that's where we are now. Demand, according to brokers, and you tell me if you know any different, you know, demand, brokers still say they got buyers stacked up, you know, with interest. But I also call it the pencil sharpening. The brokers have, or the buyers have sharpened their pencils. They're not desperate and anxious. They're not, they're patient. They're, so this whole patience has hit the market. And that's, you know, that's the opposite of what we saw in 2021.
Are the buyers today buying options? Because I've noticed quite a few ranches falling out of contract, going We've back seen, on the market.
Yeah.
So are these buyers tying them up with contingencies, maybe getting an appraisal, not being happy with the appraisal, or just kicking out their due diligence period and saying, oh, let's buy some time here.
I think
we have refundable earnest money and let's see what else happens in the next 4 months while it shakes out.
I think some of them, I think a big part of it still is replacement property or selling what they have.
Oh, so contingencies.
Yeah, I think that's happened that I've heard of a few times. Someone, you know, enters into contract to buy something, but it's contingent on selling. And presumably in that situation, they're overpriced back home. I mean, I can't think of what else would, right? Why else would their place not move?
Right.
You know, but I haven't seen a whole lot of like that. I hear in your question, I hear like kind of game playing, like, oh, just tie this up without being all that serious, just to tie it up and keep my options open. Kind of, I haven't heard anything along those lines. And it seems kind of counter to the overall mood, which is not real aggressive, not real, you know, buyers to me don't seem like they're aggressive, even if supposedly they're motivated and interested and in the market as players, they're super cautious and sharpen their pencils and waiting for what they want. And
why are properties coming back on the market?
Well, that was
out of contract.
Like I said, I think sometimes contingency on their own property. I think interest rates have played in. I mean, I've heard of ag properties, you know, interest so much, you know, our market's dominated by cash. So you'd think that interest rates didn't matter, but, there are ag buyers, that are using loans, you know.
Well, calves are doing really good right now. So
yeah,
part
yeah.
of that is I would not expect to see foreclosures being a big part of supply.
Not until the cattle market
drops back down to $700 a head. Like
did I say that
I
out
got into it?
Did I say that out loud? That that's going to happen? Am I on record?
No, I'm just speaking from experience. You buy in right now and things are good, and $1,500 calves, $1,600-$1,700 calves, and yeah, you in your mind you can buy a lot of things with that, but.
Yeah,
when they drop down to 750, like I incurred my first calf crop, it don't look too good.
Yeah, so again, I just think this is a big correction market. I've gotten a little bit of criticism for saying that. Somebody, another appraiser, said, "Isn't correction usually mean when it's going from low back up, right? Isn't that traditionally what correction means?" And I've thought a lot about that. It's like, well, as an appraiser, I think her correction just means it's correcting from either a high or a low.
Correct.
You know, and I, as an appraiser, I don't like the extremes either way. I mean, I know brokers and participating in the market's a lot funner when it's hot than when it's cold, I know, but.
Yeah, ideally, you look at that trend line going back to home prices from, I think, about 2012 to 2020. It was cyclical seasonal. So it just was a steady increase. It was only cyclical around seasonality. That was nice. That was very predictable. Interest
right.
rates were fine.
Yeah.
That was a real nice period.
Well, and you know, this has been it's a bit of a mantra of mine, but the land market in Montana is a highly imperfect market. Sometimes I even choke on the word market. Sometimes I long for a different term because I think it's a little misleading. I mean, it's not calves, it's not houses, it's not cars, it's not corn. It doesn't resemble You know, it functions so much. We've talked about this on here. It's more like fine art or antique cars or something like that. It's just a very, very imperfect market. And yeah, when it's sloppy, at almost all times, but, during the extremes and the volatility times, it's just a mess. And, you know, that creates some opportunities for some folks. Although I sometimes think that opportunity is really just dumb luck, depending on, you know, where you're at in the market, but it sure creates a lot of problems. And especially, I mean, you just think about operators, you know, actual ag operators and people dealing with estate transitions and stuff like that, and trying to make smart decisions with their asset and stuff. It's a flipping mess. And they call people like me, and it's, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to think this one out loud, think it through out loud. It's like there's a market within a market. So you take let's take an Eastern Montana, the thing that's kind of trending right now, Eastern Montana elk. Mm-hmm. You have these properties that were historically like $650 an acre, and now they're $1,200 an acre.
Right.
And that's the buyer set for that is high net worth individuals out of state. Let's throw some more love to Texas as we do every episode. Texas,
we love Texas.
High net worth Texans. Or hunters. I've heard of some big time Midwest hunters buying these properties. They're high net worth. Their opportunity cost is pretty low. They can get into these at a 1% gross annual yield. That doesn't matter to them. If they were to fall out, if they were no longer the market, it would probably become more regionalized to other higher net worth. So now we drop down to doctors and lawyers. Hmm. So there's always going to be a subset of wealth, national or regional, that's going to kind of insulate, I believe. Let me just say, I believe. Disclosure.
The opinions represented here are solely.
Yeah. You can wipe your butt with them.
they're worth what you're paying.
Yeah. So then you drop down to that next level, business owners, doctors, lawyers, probably within, let's say, 4 hours of the property. Mm. If they fall out for some reason, whatever their opportunity cost is, goes higher, that they're no longer interested in these type of luxury assets, then you get more local. And I would say you have more regional, call it within 2 hours, you have engineers and business owners again, maybe some family wealth. But we're not ever going to drop down to where it's like, oh, the rancher.
I've been waiting. When does rancher hit into this matrix?
No. And the FSA beginning farmer doesn't have a shot in hell. So
Right.
The FSA beginning farmer shouldn't even be thinking about buying land. But no, they are that group, the local farmer rancher, is such a long ways from being in the market, being a participant.
Yeah.
But you know, if things were ever to get to a point where these opportunity costs for the high net worths and the doctors, lawyers, they would be a market. The ranchers would be, but we're so far from that.
Don't farmers and ranchers? I mean, I've wondered this and I've been meaning to ask. You know, I've got lots of friends and clients that are in lending. You know, shout out to AgWest Farm Credit. You know, they're clients and supporters, Montana Land Source, and of the industry pretty strongly in general. But like, does land value, you know, say you're an owner operator and you're squeaking by, say you're doing all right. You know, you're covering your butt and you got a reasonable business and stuff, but a great piece of ground is available adjoining you that would really enhance your operation. But, you know, you can't really pencil it, but it's a good investment in its own right. I mean, does that play in? Can you get financing from a lender based on the appreciation potential of that asset rather than the production potential, you know?
We're definitely getting there. I think Farmers Business Network has a lending product that is based on appreciation. Mm. And I would suspect more private capital is going to respond to that demand, that problem, that need.
Because that's the source of value. That's just what you outlined, basically, is it's, you know, it's appreciation. It's not production.
And you said integral to their operation. I would argue, I'm not going to get into farming because I don't know farming that well, but for ranching, an expansion is rarely ever essential to an operation. You'd be better off cross-fencing and developing water at $300 an acre. I mean, and that's an astronomical value, but increase your own productivity rather than buying productivity.
Mm. Yeah. Are they tapping you for their, their consulting on farm ranch management?
No. And that's such a, I don't know why that's a foreign concept. People think they got to grow by expansion, grow internally.
Oh, that's been, don't you think that's been baked into the culture and the system for
certainly.
bigger.
Yeah. And
I mean, economy of scale, and you got to get bigger to survive. And
the big operators, you know, there is pride of ownership, pride in land and pride in assets.
Right.
And it's the old saying, I don't want to own all the land. I just want to own what's next to me.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about this heading into this podcast, actually. I mean, obviously it's no new news that the divergence of production value from real estate value has been going on for decades. I mean, you know, you could argue that started at least 40, 50 years ago, probably, right?
Certainly.
But it just gets more and more extreme. You know, where does it end? Where does, because production value has basically essentially been frozen in time. I mean, accounting for inflation and dollar value of money and stuff, it's production value, you know, commodity prices are static and land value just skyrockets, not to mention inputs.
Well, and you get into, are there lending products that take into account appreciation rather than cash flow? Rabo Agrifinance, who I worked for, they're the largest ag lender in the world based in the Netherlands. A lot of their products in Australia, New Zealand were interest only because they realized the land value was not going to, you couldn't cash flow the entire principal land value. So you just make your interest only payment for 25 years and then you're going to sell it to a larger, probably more corporate operation.
Yeah. It's just interesting, you know, where this goes, where this ends up. You know, do we just, I mean, is land value just going to never stop? And, you know,
which is a plug for my direct participation program.
Yes,
this is if we see this as a problem, this lack of ability to cash flow, that risk needs to be put on someone else with a lower opportunity cost. The operator needs to do what the operator does best. The investors get what they want out of an investment. I think that plays well into what I'm doing. I think that plays well into a pooled fund, per se, a SPV, where you have long-term ownership at today's market cap rates that do not need to be cash flowed principal and interest debt payments from cattle. And now I think hunting is becoming a real enterprise too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the land is held for its own investment.
Correct.
Separate from production in a sense.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is reality.
Yeah. I mean, think about it, even within land, all the enterprises you can have. So you could have gravel, hunting, tourism, ag. You could have a government programs enterprise. So
carbon.
I think working, I don't see a future where we, in my generation, hopefully this is a personal statement, hopefully some drastic reforms come to government spending, but I don't see a time where we do cut the farm bill and PRF, LRP, CRP, CSP, EQIP. I mean, alphabet soup grows every year.
Yeah. Right. So farming the programs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's beautiful about that within my DPP is it used to be that these government programs, they did try to slight them in favor of the small mom and pop rancher, the small owner operator.
Right.
But that was when we had direct payments and subsidies, market relief type subsidies. Now everything's being tied to conservation. And when you tie it to conservation, well, theoretically, if you're going to have a bigger impact with, say that the subsidy is like $30 an acre, and that's just a example number for pasture. Why wouldn't it, if you are creating all this positive externalities, if you're creating a common good with conservation, you wouldn't want to leave out the corporate owners. You'd want them taking up your program because they are improving whatever it is, watershed, habitat, riparian.
Well, those program administrators, you know, if they get a handful of large corporate participants that moves the needle on their program, they can document
absolutely
success versus a whole bunch of small mom and pops that
absolutely
probably half of them follow through, and you know.
And that's yet another issue, is that these government contracts are not really contracts. People don't even have to follow through with them.
Wow. I've always been surprised, you know, I'll show up on a place and it'll be the most hardcore anti-government, you know, this and that. But sure enough, there's an EQIP, you know, water development program in place.
You're talking to that person.
And I mean, I guess at times I thought, well, I guess maybe this is all as it should be. Like, I don't know. I remember one place, you know, EQIP money getting cattle off the creek. And it was a pretty ugly cattle on the creek scenario, you know, and just demolishing this pretty nice creek actually. Right. And it's like, I don't see this happening any other way.
No,
you know, this guy,
certainly not.
Because they, you know, generations, right? Like that's been there, and they're not moving that for nothing. I guess you could do stick rather than carrot at some point, but that has its problems, as we know.
Yeah, and that's Eric Belasco, the econ professor from my last podcast. He kind of laid it out that on both sides of the aisle, it's more favorable to go with the carrot and to wrap in conservation, that is politically palatable for both conservatives and I don't want to call Democrats liberals because they're becoming leftists in my mind.
Liberal is too soft a term at this point.
I have my own beliefs about, you know, the values of liberalism, but it is getting to a point where conservation is a win for both representatives. They can go celebrate that with their constituency.
Right. Yeah.
So as we get to this, where, you know, we said land values are you can't pencil them. They're out of reach. They're never coming back. Yeah. So I'm creating a new product for that.
You know, it is interesting to think about conservation becoming, I mean, you just touched on it being a large, broad political entity element in the political sphere, and thinking about land value, land management. Now that we're talking about this, I mean, that has really grown. I'm just thinking about my, you know, I'm knocking on 20 years of direct experience in this industry, in this market. And, you know, I did conservation easement appraisals and stuff like that. So I've always been kind of involved, but it definitely has grown. And, you know, we've had guests on the podcast about the carbon markets. I actually had a lengthy call with a Bloomberg journalist last week, and it was pretty interesting. You know, New York City Bloomberg journalist who was pretty blown away by some of the aspects of the Montana land market, and particularly the decoupling from production value to land value. But, you know, we talked about constant. She asked a lot about the carbon markets, and my stock answer with that is that it's just still really a, you know, market that's in its infancy. It's not really an established market out here yet, but clearly on the horizon, right? And you just think of, anyway, back to the point of conservation initiatives, conservation programs becoming more of a core feature of land value, land management. I mean, it's really, and I mean, it makes me think of, I mean, farming programs that's been around a long time for, especially in the farm sector, right? Grain and hay guys have been farming programs as deeply as the ground for a long time. But the conservation program, quote unquote, farming is.
You brought I mean, you just hit on what my belief is if carbon comes via a carrot, and I hope, and I think it will, I'm not all that worried that it's going to come via a stick, but it's another crop.
Right.
Farm it. I mean, if you're in Eastern Montana, you have two crops, livestock or three. Livestock, small grains, and hay.
Yeah.
Why not add diversity to your portfolio and farm carbon?
So I remember talking to my dad about this a couple of years ago. It was actually when Chris Mayhews was coming on the program, as you know, he's been a guest here and is helping develop this market in Montana. And I went to school with Chris, and Chris's grandfather and my father were pretty close, I think. So I was telling dad about it, and he's talking about carbon program. He said, so now we're going to pay ranchers for doing what they already do.
Has been the model since the 50s.
I was going to say, this is different now. Which is kind of funny, because he was actually a pretty staunch, you know, ag supporter, you know, ranch supporter. And but he was, you know, certainly fiscal and political conservative. So, you know, he's like, what's this bullshit where we're paying for somebody to do what they're already doing?
Well, I want to ask you a question. As I get into this DPP, direct participation program, pooled syndication of ranch real estate, I do want to consider conservation easement properties because they are sexy. They're usually, I mean, the ones that you want are mountain foothills.
Some of the best properties available are under conservation easement.
Yes, absolutely. And my longtime mentor, Denver Gilbert, one of the owners of Clark and Associates.
Who loves them.
I'm not going to speak on Denver's behalf. We were discussing this yesterday. And today, you rarely see a difference in value for the sexy mountain foothills with water and elk.
Right.
As you get further into the prairie, yeah, you're going to see that diminution of value.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, our belief is that today is kind of the front end of, in 30 years, are we going to see any difference at all?
You know, what's funny about that, when I started off about 20 years ago doing conservation easement appraisals, and they're, you know, they're tough because you have to find comps. You know, conservation easement appraisal is two appraisals. You appraise it as is, and then you appraise it with this, you know, potential easement that's going to be on it. And then in that second scenario, you have to find comps. And, you know, 20 years ago, that was pretty tough. And the big mantra in the conservation easement appraisal community is that, you know, we don't have enough sales, don't have enough sales, don't have enough sales. And that's the big problem. Now, you know, 20 years later, depending on the area you're in, you have the sales and they're not that helpful, you know, because of what you're saying.
And that is such a change in consumer tastes and preferences.
Yeah.
I'm personally in that camp, you know, me as the anti-government libertarian, Henry David Thoreau living out at Walden Pond type.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like the idea of having an unwanted partner who's on the title encumbering what I can do.
Right.
But it seems like I'm becoming the exception.
Yeah. And I guess just along the lines of, like, you know, you're talking about conservation programs becoming perhaps more inherent in land ownership, land value, you know, land trusts and conservation easements are one aspect of that, and less obscure, less unusual, less, and, you know, in some avenues they can be a resource. I mean, it's a double-edged sword. You, without a doubt, you know, you're in bed with somebody on your land. And that's a bit counter to the historic idea of land ownership in the West. You know, the whole premise is it's yours and no one else's and you can do what you damn well please. And right. But now you're in bed with somebody.
Yeah.
And if you want to, you know, some simple, potentially simple things, you know, you gotta run it by another entity. I push back. I mean, I know all those guys pretty well. And I push back that they're difficult to work with. I've found very, very few examples of that. In fact, the opposite. And I think their motivation is to be easy to work with and help stuff get done. But the terms of the easement are the terms of the easement, and their role is to enforce that. So, and there have been some issues. In fact, I think there might be some litigation going on right now in on a property, you know. And the classic scenario is it's a new owner. It's not the person that put the easement on. You know, someone comes in and buys it and either doesn't understand, doesn't read it carefully, has a cavalier attitude, and they have to go pretty hard against the terms of the easement. You know, we're not talking about tilling at the wrong time or, you know, selective logging or something. We're talking about flat out building where you're not supposed to, or, you know.
Yes.
But to your point though, you're in bed with somebody, but maybe that's a sort of a shift from what was a pretty isolationist independence kind of thing to more of a collaboration. And, you know, those guys are pretty plugged into all these programs. I mean, sometimes when somebody calls me asking in general about conservation programs, I'll point them to a land trust because some of those staffers know more about all those programs. Sometimes I'd send someone there than I would before I'd send them to FSA or something, because a lot of times those guys are so siloed. You know, they know their programs, but the land trust, some of the staffers I've known at the land trust, you know, work pretty hard at kind of knowing the whole environment of programs. And, you know, easements have changed a little bit. I mean, just getting into the weeds on that, you know, it used to be all about the tax deduction for doing an easement, but I think that's diminished a little bit and more of the getting paid for through some program to do an easement. Sage Grouse really initiative really opened that up in Eastern Montana for sure. But, you know, you can call up those guys and they'll be able to survey pretty quick whether there's any programs out there to help you purchase an easement. That's their job.
Yeah, they're salesmen.
Yeah.
It's like sleazy brokers.
Everyone's looking for their cut.
No. Those sons of bitches are selling property rights without a real estate license. Yeah. I should file a complaint with the Department of Labor there. They're competing and entering into my business agency.
I've heard that criticism for sure.
If someone out there is an accredited investor and has a ranch in mind that they would like to invest in as a limited partner, as a LP, passive investor, taxed as a passive investor, let me know. Give me a call, set up a Zoom meeting on my Calendly link, and let's talk. I'd like to hear what the market wants for DPPs of ranches. Is it Southeast Montana Trophy Elk, or does it have to be within 2 hours of Bozeman? I mean, that's kind of the big question for me. So,
interesting.
So reach out. You can also hit me up on social media. We, those are not my pronouns. That's how I refer to our team.
Them, they.
My team is everywhere on social media online. So give us your 5 cents and it'll be greatly appreciated. While I go get a coffee, Andy, you want to give your plug?
Yeah, well, I'd like to plug Montana Land Source, the closest thing to an MLS for farms and ranches across Montana. And we map and track every listing and every sale in the state and have lots of content on the website at mtlandsource.com, including live market stats. Every day we're combing the market, updating listings, updating sales, and those are reflected in our stats online. We make our money by selling subscriptions, but there's lots of free content to get started on to see if the product is of value to you. So check out mtlandsource.com.
All right, let's get into
hot button issue, huh?
Hot button, subjective, opinionated, non-data driven, maybe hyperbolic, because I love hyperbole.
All the things I love.
Yes.
All the reasons I became an appraiser.
Well, all the reasons I have a podcast. Fact check me. I don't care.
Is this the fact-free venue?
This is my show. I pay for the hosting. I get to say what I want. So you and I have talked about, with many guests and among ourselves, the importance of culture and community and how you put a value on that, what attracts people to Montana, the quality, characteristics, code of the West, the very unique culture we have in Montana. is that something worth protecting? Is it worth conserving? And is there a obligation or a duty with these land trusts to protect community and culture as much as open space and real property and wildlife and habitat? So I know I'm not going to name any names, but one of our land trusts in Montana, they promote the shit out of that, that they are not just conserving open space and ag properties and wildlife habitat, they are conserving community and culture. Yet their board is made up of individuals who are billionaires, people who live in Greenwich, Connecticut, which is like all billionaires. Their board is made up of people in Los Angeles, Chicago, New York City. And that is a Montana organization. And I'm thinking, how can these individuals make informed experience decisions from their experience to protect community and culture? I just, that is, to me, that's gross misrepresentation. If that were in a brochure, that should be turned into the Department of Labor and your local realtor organization.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I haven't been tracking. I guess I haven't been following who's on the board as closely as you have, because I know in times past, I know that there have been locals, on that board, but
they get a token DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, a token local who's there only for representation.
Well, it's interesting. I don't think that's the way it was in the early days. I think in the early days it was, boards were made up of, locals and, you know, but sounds like to me, like those organizations are probably in a situation where they have to balance like you said, the preserving of local culture, but, the funding, and the, you know, the pockets, and that's why they have to entice some of their funders with board positions. And I'm assuming that's part of the mix.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, how do you raise $60 million of donations if you are in Plentywood, Montana?
Right.
You kind of got to go to New York City to do that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, what comes to my mind. So, you know, I've worked with the Nature Conservancy and watched, I guess you could say, the Nature Conservancy. They've had a large presence in Montana for years, owned some big ranches, and particularly the Centennial Valley, you know, have a big presence there and up at Malta and all that stuff, you know. And what, and you know, they had some trouble. This might predate you a little bit, but remember the Washington, was it the Washington Post or the New York Times, the big expose about, it was about 20 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, of the TNC and the insider deals with their board members. And it was a big deal. Three part expose of where they really got their hands slapped and for these kind of practices. But watching them on the ground in Montana, and even knowing some of the individuals personally, like I really saw this transition from this kind of outside, you know, environmental/conservation organization coming in with big ideas to do big things, but watching them evolve and adjust and learn how to become neighbors, which means integrating into the culture a little bit. And, you know, it's interesting. Outsiders come in, whether they're a landowner or a group, and they come in and you watch how much the culture rubs off on them and how much they rub off on the culture. And in the case of the Nature Conservancy, I've really seen a lot of change and a lot of, and they've learned how to work, and you know, they have the program. I hope I'm not mixing this up with the APR, but don't they have their own wild beef program or whatnot, where they offer neighbors lease on grass for some in exchange for some conservation practices? I think the APR does that too. But anyway, some innovative programs. And what, and now I'll jump to the APR. The APR is the new kid on the block, especially, I mean, you know, Nature Conservancy has been around for decades. APR is relatively new.
And they are a nonprofit.
Yeah. Both nonprofits. I think the APR is still in a period of sorting out how well they're going to fit in the neighborhood or not. Cause there's still, you know, obviously there's more controversy. You know, Nature Conservancy is integrated more and better by now. Of course they're not, they're not as big. They're not as, they've not tried to change things as fast or bought as many places up and that kind of stuff. But I think the APR, and I've seen signs of it already, that they've modified, you know, their stances and whatnot, but you know, they're still figuring out how to fit in the neighborhood.
That is my, you know, if I'm going to be an armchair quarterback, my critique of APR, TNC versus these land trusts, I see the land trust as a Trojan horse. They are disguised as a local group, local community working group, and they're just selling this novelty to Greenwich, Connecticut. They're selling it to New York City. It's to me, it's disingenuous, the land trusts are, whereas APR, TNC, they have their values, they have their mission vision statement. They, from what I can tell, they hold to it. Mm-hmm. I think they do stick to their guns, and they're unafraid of saying, no, this is our money.
Yeah.
This is what we raised the money for. This is what we're going to do with the land.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting, and I'll say the name, you know, Montana Land Reliance, the biggest Montana land trust. I mean, and you kind of referred to this earlier, you know, the cows versus condos, campaign, I guess you could call it. I will say, I think the land trust was early in transitioning from, I mean, that cows versus condos is pretty classic, because I think most would argue 30 years ago, the conservation community did not care much for cattle across the board.
Certainly.
Cattle across that board were kind of the enemy. It seems to me that the land trust, Montana Land Alliance, was kind of early in making that transition to know open space agriculture has value. Yeah, you know, hence the campaign. So I do see them as a little more insider in terms of, and you know, just to get clear with people, you know, land trusts, you know, they are facilitating conservation easements with landowners. So they're a little bit more, I don't know if boots on the ground is the right word, but they're working with landowners, you know, to do conservation easements, whereas TNC and APR generally are buying their own ground and doing what they want with it, kind of thing, with some exception. I mean, you know, it's a little bit more complicated than that, but you know, land trusts just facilitate a open market opportunity for landowners to
voluntary transaction.
Yeah. But I do see your point, and I do think that's the rub, is, you know, these out of state funders are a big part of their, you know, sort of success matrix, and so they have to walk this line between, are they local, working with locals, made up of locals, or are they out of state funded? You know, and I what I've seen, I think some of these board members you're talking about, I think, you know, a wealthy out of state landowner comes, buys a piece of ground, goes through the easement process, and now is welcomed onto the board. And you know, and they're, you know, I think some of them bring more to the table. You know, it's coming to my mind now, like, you know, some guy might be a legitimate, you know, financial, you know, wizard kind of deal. It's like, oh God, this guy on the board will be amazing kind of deal. Not, you know, not just placating to the wealth, but the skill set and the, well, and the networking and the, right. So yeah, that this guy,
all the benefits.
Yeah. This guy is like you said, a Connecticut, big wig kind of deal. So it just smooths those gears for more deals. So yeah, I think it's a position they're in.
And I may or may not be talking about referencing any one particular land trust.
Yeah, because there are a bunch of them.
Yeah, I'm making a broad generalization because I don't want to burn any bridges, but I do want to broadcast some local sentiment. That
yeah.
This, if it doesn't feel right, you know, that's something to address.
Well, I can tell you when I got started, I haven't done a conservation easement appraisal in a while, so I'm a little bit out of the loop, but it used to be more aggressive. I mean, I remember dealing with some of the guys from the land trust, like, you know, sometimes dealing with incomplete information sort of provided to the landowner. And here I come along as the appraiser with a different story. And there was some period back earlier in my career where there was some tough negotiations and tough moments. And I feel like the land trust got a lot more sophisticated, and, you know, we kind of figured things out, and the new generation that I see managing these land trusts are more sophisticated, and, you know, things like they know their lane, and they would never make assertions that is on the appraiser, for example, right? And for the land value scenario. So the things have gotten better in that way. And I mean, just to step back to when I get calls about, and my position on conservation easements is they're simply a tool. You know, they're a tool in the toolbox. They're a program, like you're saying, a potentially farmable program. You know, if it works for you, great. If it doesn't, great. You know, but, and I certainly push back on if I sense any oversell or any kind of, you know, and there, I don't see it so much from the land trust themselves, but sometimes it seems like there are other conservation entities that just pick up that trumpet call and, you know, everything needs to be a conservation easement. And it's like, well, slow down a little bit. You know, it's just a tool. It has its benefits, has its drawbacks, right? If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
Yeah, we could go deeper into that because a lot of these are funded by NRCS.
Yeah.
So you're using public money that's going to benefit one family, one landowner, financially, economically. And is that a good use of taxpayer dollars, or is the general public getting their value out of that conservation easement?
Huge question.
Yeah, it's...
I mean, in some ways, I think the argument for it is, you know, we're able to do, we, the public, are able to do things without having to buy land or whatnot, right? It's like more efficient process because we're, you know, able to just buy a fractional interest in a land to get the X result. But that doesn't necessarily fully answer your question.
it's like buying a fractional interest in Coulter's DPP so you can go hunt on it. And you can have all the recreational benefits and none of the management responsibilities.
Is that going to be your marketing pitch directly against conservation, against land trust? You choose me over.
Well, you bring up, so there are these problems that are creating friction, and these problems are increasing land values. I think that's in the buyer pool, the billionaire class that has entered Montana in many different aspects. So if that is a problem, my solution is different than TNC's Grass Bank, which I think that they have a great solution, but they are a nonprofit, and I'm a capitalist, economic driven person. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen TNC scale that. I haven't seen them replicate the Matador recently. It's been a long time since they've done a grass bank, and I am not the APR. They're a 501c3 nonprofit. They have their mission, vision, values. Again, no return involved there. I'm not the land trust. So again, I mean, there's no economic benefit. So I'm more like the free market solution to this problem of land reach out of touch to most people.
Yeah, it's an interesting diversification in the marketplace. And I could see where it could certainly have some appeal because all the things you outlined, you know, nonprofits and government programs and, you know, have downsides. And I do think in general, certainly in Montana, well, I should qualify old Montana. You know, tends to be conservative, and you know, despite us pulling in more federal dollars than we put back out, and despite ag, you know, being a highly subsidized industry, we are in our hearts try to be libertarians and fiscally conservatives, but I think we are a bit tired of program creep and you know, that kind of stuff. Even as some of these programs maybe are, you know, the best thing ever, it's just there's so many of them, and it is hard to analyze if we're getting a return.
Yeah, old Montana. I think you're going to get coined that term. I think you're going to own it now, like old Mexico. I think the day of the independent guy, the independent rancher who's freedom and sovereign and stands on his own, I think that's dead.
Yeah, I I was afraid you were going to say is coming to an end, and I was going to say the same because, and it's so, you know, isn't the classic scenario you see this beat to shit old ranch, which is A, really inefficient.
Yes.
Not supporting the people involved or the landscape well.
No.
But goddamn, they're free, you know.
Yeah.
Even though they're probably getting checks, you know, in one form or another. And like I said, you know, their road to town isn't paid for by the county or even the state. A lot of that's federal. You know, I always thought it was $1.30, but something I saw the other day, it was more like $1.70. $1.70 comes into Montana for every buck that leaves in our tax regime. And I think, to me, roads is one of the big ones that I think that ties into. We don't pay for our own roads. We got too few people and too many roads.
Well, we should privatize them.
Private roads, toll roads everywhere.
Yes,
you go.
Everywhere we go.
This is, God damn it, this is the DeVries mud ass 40 gravel. They're charging.
Washboards 2 feet deep.
No speed limit, but you might want to drive 15 miles an hour. No speed limit, but you might want
to
drive 15.
In fact, we recommend 65 to just blow over those washboards.
It starts a nice little hum. I think it's an opera when you get going fast enough. It just hums.
But I mean, I'd like to continue with that because I mean, how does that family, that entity, that old, that multi-generational family ranch that is starving to death, literally and financially, you know, mired in inefficiency, with a asset that's exploded, even though it's not been necessarily the best cared for. Like, where does that, and this, you know, there's all these new opportunities. I mean, I think both you and I try to look at change with an eye to what are the opportunities. So there's more programs, there's more opportunities, but that guy just still seems to be in the spiral.
Yeah, I mean, that's what leads to gentrification, is you have a wealthy, high-valued people who see the value in the assets, area, geography, neighborhood, whatever it is, and they have the resources to polish it. They want to see it live up to its full potential, and that's, you take a shithole neighborhood and you gentrify it.
So I loved the podcast you did this spring with Dallas on the Ranching for Profit. Dallas Mount. You guys touched on this. So why isn't efficiency of operation? Why isn't the family and the next generation getting engaged with, you know, creating a more vibrant business entity on the landscape that has place for the next generation and has some momentum for a thriving business? Am I going to answer my own question that the market is so poor that it's just that opportunity isn't there? You know what I mean? Why?
I would say it's a generational, the boomer generation who owns the land. I would say that they are obstructionist to the millennials who are taking over. The young guy and his wife, they want to do more enterprises. They want to change with the times and either do direct to consumer beef or bring in more conservation programs, tourism, hunting, monetize hunting via land trust, free plug for Nick. So you see the millennials hunger for that, but the control and the obstruction from the landowner, the guy who built all that equity, it's just not getting turned over. And it's a complete generational.
So I graduated out of the ag department at MSU, which is our land grant, Montana State here in Montana. I graduated in 2001, and I was a non-traditional student. I was 30 years old, and I was very disheartened. I didn't see much innovation or I felt like the ag, I think it was on in transition at that point because things started to shift. Now they got sustainable food systems and well, recently the ranch management program, Dan Scott, who we've had on here and that sort of stuff. But at the time it was like, well, here, I'll tell you. So I was a transfer student because I had gone to school in Northern California. So I was coming in as a transfer student, doing a whole day of orientation. And the last bit of it, I was in a room with other ag transfer students, and it was a vice president of ag came to talk to us, and he was all this great time to be in ag, all our programs, blah, blah, blah. And then almost under his breath, he said, just, you know, just don't be a producer. And it was like, so I felt like there's been this culture in that land grant and the whole industry, you know, just, you know, get bigger, you know, lean into technology, but just sell to the same market and don't learn, don't know anything about markets or marketing. Don't know anything about gross versus net. That doesn't, that doesn't really matter. Right. Like this real, real lack of innovation and very separate from any other business sector, right? Like, I mean, a whole different matrix for risk, for one thing, leverage the hell out of everything. You know, don't worry about it. It'll work itself out. Like, why is ag so separate from any other business venture in so many regards? And does that not lead to that? I still have this image of this old guy, this old boomer, you know, withering away on the place, his kids bailing, and they're going to sell the estate. They're going to sell the land for the land value, and the ag operation, the tradition of the ag operation, all that is evaporates. Hold on. They hold on as long as they can.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you just painted what has been. That's the way it has been. Right. So how would things change? Are things going to change? I would say, business as usual. What has been will continue to be.
And even though we're talking about this being a change, which is for sure is, it's still remarkable how many guys are out there like that though. I mean, we can drive out of Billings, you know, right now. And once we get a little bit out of town, you can go by four or five places that are that same guy before you hit a new ownership regime. I mean, it's the countryside is still pretty well dominated by.
Absolutely.
You go to the coffee shop in any given small town and all those old guys are in there. They're still hanging on. They're still.
Yeah. It just takes time. A generation is what, every 30 years or something. Mm-hmm. So I'm not like counting down the days, but as boomers fade out and die away, we're your generation X, no one really yep. cares about.
But. We like it that way. We're the stealth.
Hey, you're the disgruntled ones who came up with like Nirvana and rage music, grunge music, but it's just going to be a slow generational shift. And I can't help but plug my own DPP again. And I think I'm just getting set up for that there is, the future is probably absentee owned, investor owned, institutional owned land for the appreciation and for the technical expertise required to optimize that asset. I don't think you can have. So, and Will Harris of White Oak Farms, White Oak Pastures, big, big celebrity guy in regenerative. This is where him and I disagree. He staunchly opposes my view of specialists separating enterprises. Whereas, you know, I'm literally putting my money where my mouth is and saying, no, I think that's the.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You brought up culture earlier and we've been talking a lot about economics and land economics, and it's, you know, it's clear as a bell that the land economic scenario is heading to exactly what you just said, right? There's that path is pretty clear that investor owned, institutional owned, wealthy people owned, right? That, I mean, how can it be otherwise? But again, going back to that boomer guy aging out on the place, what really seems to be the death, if you want to call it that, or the transition, there's a culture component too. I mean, if the land, if the rural landscape had appeal and opportunity for young people, even if the land value, even given the land economic situation, that could be a game changer. I think when the culture changes like it has, and I'm particularly thinking about just not having much appeal or opportunity for young people, for the next generation, that's really a harbinger of change, you know?
Yeah, the opportunity is going to come, in my belief, it's going to come in nuanced ways. So be a specialist outfitter, guide, hunter. If you want to be on the land and live in Broadus, Montana, build that book of business, become the expert.
Be a coder during the off season remote for Google, and then totally. Put on your outfitter hat during the hunting season and go bag some bulls.
Absolutely. Yeah. find, I mean, we live in this decentralized world, find a good paying income consulting or remote work elsewhere. And for the ranchers, I've become the best animal husbandry rancher producer there is. And you'll be leasing land, but there's no reason to be stretched thin on P&I and try to own the land when you can grow your one specialty enterprise and do it very well. And then diversify away from that. Get your 401k. I mean, ranchers don't have 401ks.
Right. You know, I don't know if I've shared this story or not, but you know, I aspired to be a producer. That's what I wanted to do in my 20s, going into my 30s. And of course, not having family land and, you know, that kind of stuff hit a big old brick wall in that deal, you know. And I can remember getting pretty jaded about the whole thing. But then I also remember having a little bit of an attitude adjustment, realizing that I was expecting salary and 401k. And I mean, I had a young family and, you know, wanted a respectable career. But looking back historically, it's like, well, farmers, you know, ranchers don't historically travel, have 401ks. I mean, you know, I was, you know, my kids were coming up in an age where it's like, you know, iPads were expected or this or that, right? So I was imposing a modern idea of income and, you know, career support on an industry that has never necessarily supported that.
Right. A legacy industry. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, Andy, I'm going to get one final ask in as we wrap it up. So anyone who's listening, again, that's an accredited investor, please let me know if you see a DPP pooled resources syndication as a solution to what we've been talking about, the many different subjects where we identify some of the problems. If you think that pooled resources, direct participation programs, passive investors is a legitimate free market capitalistic approach to solving a problem, let me know. I'd love to hear from you. And Andy, time to get your plug in.
Yeah.
Or your ask of our audience.
Yeah, I'll just ask people, go to mtlandsource.com and check out all our resources. I think that goes hand in hand with what Coulter's doing as far as being a resource on the market and what's happening and keeping up on trends. And we've got the best and most current data out there on the land market. So check out mtlandsource.com.
Thanks for coming in, Andy.
Yeah, thanks, Coulter. It's good.
August 1st, 2023. Let's see what happens.
Listeners of the Ranch Investor Podcast who are receiving this immense value for free, thanks for tuning in. I do have an ask. In place of advertising, I do not monetize this on Spotify, Apple, anywhere. I don't click the monetize button, so I do have to get a plug in here. And I ask, what I'd like from you is to hear some feedback. So on our social media, please share this episode. All I ask in return for not having promotions and advertising is that you share this, send a text, get it out there so more people can enjoy what we're producing. Thanks for tuning in.
We feature only the best accredited and established rural real estate professionals who analyze, transact, and manage billions of dollars annually. No newbies here. Click subscribe on your streaming platform so you know when the latest episode has dropped.